Hello, and welcome to Color Me Healthy, a production of the Community Health Center of Buffalo. Color Me Healthy focuses on wellness for communities of color and how we can all develop a better quality of life. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by Community Health Center employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the Community Health Center or any of its officials. This program is meant to be used for general informational purposes only. While this program provides information on such topics as health and wellness, the subject matter discussed is not intended to be a substitute for seeking care and service from a health professional. In all instances, even where a guest is a licensed physician, listeners should not view the opinions and perspectives expressed on the program as medical advice. Listeners are also encouraged to pay attention to the credentials and professional qualifications of the program's guests. In instances where a guest is not a licensed medical professional, listeners should note that the guest is not legally authorized to practice medicine in any setting. Listeners are always encouraged to consult with their own personal healthcare professional.
Hello, I'm your host, Kyle Shalahorn, Education Program Coordinator at the Community Health Center Buffalo. Addiction is an issue that impacts communities of color in a variety of ways. In this two-part series, I'll be discussing this topic with Chris Thrasher. Chris is the Senior Director of Substance Use Disorders and Recovery at the Clinton Foundation. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl. It's great to be here with all of you.
So to start things off, Chris, why don't you share about your background and how you came to work at the Clinton Foundation?
Sure. Thanks again for having me. My work at the Clinton Foundation really was sort of a culmination of about 15 years of work in public health. I actually am born and raised in Buffalo, New York, and moved down after getting much of my education in New York, moved down to Atlanta, Georgia, where I took a job at a medical school, Morehouse School of Medicine, working for President Clinton's Surgeon General that served with him in his second term, Dr. David Satcher. And I worked for Dr. Satcher for almost 14 years, and it really led to us creating the Satcher Health Leadership Institute. And at the end of my tenure there, I was co-leading that center.
So that sounds like a great opportunity to grow and learn and develop your skills and understanding of a variety of health conditions, whether it be addiction, mental health, and so forth. How has your own personal experience helped you as well in terms of that that experience?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. I have lived experience as a person in long-term recovery, and that certainly has shaped the way that I approach many of these challenging public health issues. I think that when you come at it from the perspective of just, you know, what we learn in the ivory towers, I think that is good. But I think having lived experience, really understanding what it's like to be a person in long-term recovery really does help with regard to addiction. Now, that's not the only issue that I worked on in public health. Actually, I am formally trained in human sexuality education. And so much of the work that I did with Dr. Satcher early on was in human sexuality. But that really led to sort of all different aspects of public health.
So it's interesting when you talk about all these different opportunities and the experience you've had, it's all led to where you're at right now. So in your role right now with the Clinton Foundation, what are some of the initiatives you're working on? Like, sort of, what are some of the things that you're doing to advance, whether it be research or policy in this area?
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's a bit of a loaded question because there's so much that we really do at the foundation. But my specific sort of day-to-day challenges are really focused on substance use disorders and recovery at the foundation. And, you know, needless to say, the opioid epidemic is one that has caught the attention of basically all the American people. Right now, what we know is that 72,000 lives were lost last year in 2017. And if you do the math, that equates to about 197 or 198 lives lost every single day. And down to the minute, that's another life lost to an overdose every 8 minutes in this country. So, you know, if you think about just to kind of give that a visual, think about the local football stadium in your city here in Buffalo, New York. That would be Rich Stadium, packed to the gills. And every single one of those people die of an overdose in 1 year. And this is the United States of America. We can and should do better. So the idea that 72,000 lives lost is certainly a motivator. It gets me out of bed every day trying to figure out how we can get a handle on this epidemic. And so with that, we at the Clinton Foundation have tried to figure out what populations we can really work in, what demographics we can work in to try to make a difference. And we have carved out what we think are a few unique niches that we can fill. The first is working with the faith-based community. And the faith-based community is a very unique group of folks because, you know, this group has kind of their finger on the pulse of the community, meaning that often when many people have issues around addiction, they'll either go to their physician or their preacher.
Right.
And what we know is that the physicians and the preachers don't get enough education. I mean, they're not getting it in seminary. They're not getting it in medical school.
Right.
And so they're ill-prepared. They're not equipped to dealing with the opioid epidemic. Now, a lot of people will say, well, how did we get here as a nation? You know, and you can debate that, you know, all day long. You know, is it Big Pharma's fault? Is it the physician's fault? You know, I think everyone has a piece of the blame.
Right.
But you know, what I've seen as I go across the country and I talk to different communities is that, you know, there was clearly an overprescribing of opioids.
Mm-hmm.
That has definitely not really been debated, that people were prescribing these. But they were prescribing them because they were told that not only were they an effective way of treating the pain, but they also were non-addicting.
Right.
And so you really sort of had this almost new brand of addict because pain became the fifth vital sign.
Mm-hmm.
So physicians were graded on the way that they were treating pain. And if you didn't treat pain effectively, you got a bad grade. And then that was tied to reimbursements. And so then as a way of trying to effectively treat the pain, they were giving these opioids.
Mm-hmm.
They were incredibly addictive. The people that were taking them became addicted in like 5 or 6 days. And then they needed more. They were eventually cut off. And so they went out to the streets to find or fix, you know, their addiction, which led to heroin. You know, and so it's kind of the perfect storm.
Right.
So working with faith communities has been an opportunity to really work with congregations. And congregations are made up of everyone, you know. So you have parents and teachers and lawyers and doctors and, you know, social. I mean, everybody's in the congregation. So you really have this kind of cross section. And what we know from the opioid epidemic is it's a cross section of folks that are that are affected by this disease. I mean, we're not having people, you know, when I talk to addicts that have been out in the streets for 15, 20 years, you know, and they're homeless and they've lost their job and their families and, you know, all this stuff. That's not what we're seeing with the opioid epidemic. We're seeing kids that had a wisdom tooth pulled out. We're seeing, you know, daughters that sprained their ankle on the lacrosse field and they're prescribed these pills and they become addicted.
Right.
And so it's a new kind of almost brand of addict that we're seeing. Faith communities, people of faith, are incredibly influential, but we have to equip them with the knowledge and the skills and the abilities that they need to have a conversation. When I talk to faith leaders, one of the first things we ask them is, what is it that you need? And what we hear time and time again is, we lack a language from the pulpit to discuss these issues. We don't know how to start the conversation. We don't want to alienate certain people in our congregation, so we just don't talk about it. So what we're doing is we're working with these men and women to give them the language that they need to effectively address addiction, substance use disorders, and recovery, to really understand what that's about. And I have story after story of how we've been able to work with these faith leaders in a way that has really been starting to move the needle, change the way people think about it. Because stigma, as you know, Carl, is our biggest barrier.
So, Chris, given that faith leaders are so important in the whole equation of helping those in the community, I mean, we know that communities of color are disproportionately affected. How can our faith leaders help in this battle to help the community?
Well, I think our faith leaders play a critical role in this whole equation. You know, the truth is that Sunday is still the most segregated day in our country, which is both an opportunity and a challenge. It's an opportunity because it allows this sort of cross-section of people to come together and have conversations on difficult topics. But faith leaders are so good at educating, motivating, and mobilizing communities, right? They're inspiring. They are people that just are looked to help people through difficult times. People turn to their religious leaders in times of crisis for guidance. But having these religious leaders feel knowledgeable, feel equipped to have these conversations is absolutely key. And so we need to do a better job at helping our religious leaders recognize how substance use disorders affect their communities, their congregants, right? And once we're able to do that, I think we're able to then have congregants go to their religious leaders and be able to get the answers that they are seeking.
Yeah, and I would say also the same thing with mental health as well. I mean, you know, addiction, mental health, the entire spectrum you would consider. So that's absolutely right.
Absolutely. I mean, it's and unfortunately, this is not being taught in seminary, you know. And so I think it's up to all of us to work together. But see, that's what worship is all about. You know, it's about coming together for a common purpose. It's about finding a common language, right? And so substance use disorders really needs a common language that we can all understand and we can all speak. And it can really start with our religious leaders being able to express to our congregants a common language that resonates with all of us, that sends the message, I get it, and this is a safe place to come and talk about your issues.
Absolutely. Now, you know, I love that whole idea of working with faith communities because, you know, certainly communities of color, you know, the African-American community, the Latino community, you know, these are groups that really are, I guess you say, almost have their finger on the pulse. These are the boots on the ground, you know, the clergy that are trying to help people. And as you said, may oftentimes not have the tools in which to do so. But sounds like the work that you're doing is addressing that.
Yeah, well, we're definitely addressing. I mean, we recognize that, listen, you know, this epidemic affects all of us, like I said. But in particular, when drugs enter communities that are underserved, undereducated, and really they have a way of just taking a stranglehold on these people. And I mean, we saw it clearly in the 1980s with the crack epidemic. Our prisons became our mental health treatment facilities. They became our drug rehabilitation centers, because we had this belief in the country that if we just locked them up, it would fix the problem. And we know that that's not the case. Today at the Clinton Foundation, we use a social determinants of health approach, mm-hmm. where we look at, you know, where people grow up, where they play, where they work. I would add where they worship. All impact how they are experiencing total health and well-being.
Right.
And so by using a social determinants of health model or approach, we're able to treat the whole person, mm-hmm. not just the addiction.
Right.
In fact, many, many years ago in the 80s, there's a rehab center that's quite well known called Hazleton, and they recently merged with Betty Ford. Mm-hmm. So they're now Hazleton Betty Ford. They developed a model called the Minnesota model. And back then, it was actually pretty groundbreaking. Now, when I tell you what it is, you'll say, well, of course, that makes such sense. But it was to treat addiction from a physical, mental, and spiritual component. Mm-hmm. See, back in the 80s, we didn't really think no one really even knew what that meant. Mm-hmm. Tell you, when I went to rehab myself, this is just to show you how broken the system really was. We were told early on in rehab to identify as an addict and an alcoholic. Now, this is a guy, myself, who never really drank, but they told me I was an alcoholic. Well, come to find out, the reason why we were taught to identify as an addict and an alcoholic is because back then, if we identified as both, they were treating two diseases and they could double bill the insurance company as being able to treat two diseases.
Wow.
So, you know, being naive, I mean, now today, obviously that would never fly.
Right.
But they don't even want to pay for one disease, let alone two, right?
Right, right.
But with the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act that Patrick Kennedy worked so hard on, those things are finally changing.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about access, because you just touched on it a little bit. You know, one of the issues that I think is important in many ways for all communities, whether it be communities of color, rural communities, even suburban communities, for folks who might be having insurance issues, among others, there's a lot of issues with access to care. So what are your thoughts on access? What are your thoughts on how people are trying to get help when they need it, but may not be able to?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think with access, you have to look at one's ability to understand and recognize where stigma is present, because stigma is the biggest barrier to access, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we believe that everyone should have access to quality healthcare in this country. And I don't think that's a Republican or Democrat issue. I really don't. At the end of the day, when we're talking about access to healthcare, to be the healthiest person we can be, that should not be something that polarizes people. That should not be something that is a Republican or a Democrat. I think that's just an us issue.
Right.
So to have access, what we need to do is we need to really start from a top-down approach, my opinion, a top-down approach in educating everyone as to what total health and well-being really looks like. Stigma, as I said, you know, it's easy to talk about stigma, but if you don't understand how stigma really does play a role in preventing access, we'll never gain access. Mm. Okay. So stigma deals with the language that we use. So I'm not a crackhead. I'm not an addict, but I'm a person in long-term recovery.
Right.
Right. I mean, something as simple as that, it sounds simple, but you would be amazed. I mean, just the term clean, because the opposite of clean is dirty. Right. And so the issue that we're dealing with in recovery when we say, well, I'm clean, meaning what? So if I'm a using addict, am I dirty?
Hmm.
You know, I mean, but people don't think about terminology when we're talking about addiction.
Right.
Right. So, you know, we're trying to change that whole kind of vernacular in our country. We're trying to change that and allow people to still have these conversations, but have them in such a way that people will really be able to understand that this is not a moral failing, but rather this is a disease just like diabetes, you know, and we would never want to deny our loved one of the life-saving insulin that they need to maintain a healthy life. So why do we want to deny the person, you know, that suffers with a substance use disorder the treatment that they need to maintain a healthy lifestyle?
At this time, we're going to break and follow up with part two of our conversation on addiction in our next segment. I'd like to thank my guest, Chris Thrasher, Senior Director of Substance Use Disorders and Recovery at the Clinton Foundation. For more information on Color Me Healthy, please visit our website at chcb.net/podcast. You can also follow us on our Facebook page or on the Podbean mobile app. If you have any comments or show suggestions, you can email us at colormehealthy@chcb.net. For Color Me Healthy, I'm Carl Schallhorn. Be well.